Well, John Zerzan, an American anarchist, primitive philosopher, and author, works to criticize agricultural civilization as inherently oppressive, advocating drawing upon the ways of life of prehistoric humans as an inspiration for what a free society should look like. Some subjects of his criticisms include domestication, language, symbolic thought, such as mathematics and art, and the concept of time. His controversial opinions about the late Steve Jobs and how high-tech communications are doing more to isolate the average person than integrate them into fulfilling and productive social situations. This and much more will be the subject under discussion for the next 3 hours. We will welcome John Zerzan in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Do you hear that in the background? That's going to become the national anthem. You know what I'm saying? Do you hear that? The shrieking siren. Well, I don't know. It's been 10 years and 3 months since the great Art Bell interviewed John Zerzan. This man is a student of and a proponent of stuff I haven't talked about for a long time. So we'll see how it goes. Just a couple of, I don't know about you, John. I was more of a yippie with short hair. You know? Well, how are you? Where have you been for the last decade?
Oh, I've been around. I've really been traveling a lot. I've been getting to talk about some of these things. For example, I've been in India 3 times in the last 4 years. And there, too, I think people are struck by the madness as we careen along into the technosphere and industrialize the world and the whole rest of it. I think more people are taking it seriously. I think, you know, questions such as the ones I've posed, you know, the questioning or the indictment of what's going down in some primary ways. Yeah, that's been the big thing. I never had much money, and I thought, what am I going to miss in my lifetime by not having any money? And the only real thing I thought of was I won't be able to see much of the world because I won't have the money. But that has changed in the past 10 years. It started a little bit before I had that marvelous 3 hours with Art Bell 10 years ago.
Well, what do you want changed, you know, without some of Steve Jobs' devices? Would have been difficult to put any sort of an interview with you together at all tonight, as a matter of fact, I blew my router up. And so for a while there, I had to rely on the Steve Jobs iPhone to get some internet so I could pull your bio down and everything else. So, I mean, are you an advocate of, like, going back to the sticks? I mean, how far back do you want to roll it back?
I'd like to go back to the Stone Age, quite possibly. I mean, there's so many parts of this. One part of it is, how did we lose community? But, you know, for starters there, in terms of what you just said, John, I think it's quite true that we wouldn't be having this conversation either, of course, and that's where we're at these days, whether we like it or not. And that's been, it's kind of a contradiction or even a hypocrisy, as some people say, in terms of what I try to do. In other words, you should be, in fact, Art Bell said, well, you should be living in a cave then, to be consistent. You know, how can you use these things, you know, if that's what you're talking about? But then the dilemma is just precisely that, though. I mean, I'm trying to contribute something to the public conversation, and if I were sitting in a cave, if there was an available cave anyway, then I wouldn't be trying to be part of the, you know, the dialogue. So there you have it. I mean, you're stuck.
I'm curious to know what Mr. Bell, what was, just for the hell of it, what was his overall take on you? I mean, I don't remember the program. I listened to a lot of them, but I didn't look up this one. Mm-hmm. Don't even know if it can be looked up. Probably. It's probably immortalized on YouTube somewhere. Another technological device. But forget about all of that. How did you get on with Art?
Well, I thought he was essentially very curious and very open-minded. He seemed to find it very... he was bemused by the fact that there could be people who really don't want all this stuff. And I remember he was saying, I've got a computer in every room. I mean, are you serious? You know, he kept, and I think that's why he didn't go to the phone lines until I think there was like 15 minutes left, because he kept kicking it around. He wanted to discuss it. So I thought it was fine. I mean, he was raising. raising all kinds of questions and objections and so forth, and that's the thing. That's the point, I think, to try to wrestle with all this stuff.
That's okay with me. I mean, I remember back in the college days, there was always in the humanities department, if you took any humanities courses, you were going to eventually be put into groups and told to design your perfect utopia. And inevitably, it was like, well, we'll do our food this way, and we'll do our water that way, and then we'll all get together and we'll build houses. It'll be great. But before long, the people were squabbling. And I'm just wondering, if you go back to the uncivilized, with little quotes around it, the uncivilized beginnings, the prehistoric days, I mean, don't you find the same problems, or isn't it human nature which has driven us toward technological development anyway? Greed and desires like that?
No, this is a fundamental question. But, you know, in the 1980s, I discovered the anthropological literature, and that was a brand new thing for me. I'd never studied it, and I was working on other things, and it was just really by chance that I uncovered it. And it really influenced my thinking in a huge way, because it turns out, and really these things, I'm just going to lay out a few kind of basic things. Anthropology 101, it's really the orthodox stuff. It's not dreamed up by some anarchists or something. Namely, people didn't work much. We worked vastly more than, and these are big generalizations, of course. Women weren't objectified. The natural world wasn't systematically destroyed, and on down the road. There was no organized violence, meaning warfare, because people were living in band society with 50, 60 people. They wouldn't even have had the resources to start war, really, on anything like we know it. So, I was thinking, well, how incredible. We lived that way for something like 2 million years. And what changed it was agriculture, was domestication. We started, we turned away from the freer life of more or less taking what nature gives, moving around somewhat, perhaps, and just taking what was there. It worked out pretty well. And band society was essentially a face-to-face egalitarian life of sharing. And again, all this sounds like rose-colored glasses and stuff, but no, this is the picture. There's really no debate about it in general terms. It depends on when and where and so forth you're talking about to get specific, you know, to get into the nuances of things. But, I mean, that sounds incredibly utopian. And there's a fellow named Marshall Solins, and I think he's still around. He was the head of the anthropology department at Michigan, and he's been kind of a dean of anthropology for years. He wrote a book called Stone Age Economics, and what is the key thing is the first chapter, which stands alone as an essay, a rather famous one, called The Original Affluent Society. And he was talking about band society in a very witty kind of way. He was talking about economics and how Paleolithic individuals would measure up against modern bourgeois, you know, capitalist economics. And he said, well, they'd lose on every count. I mean, there would be no contest. But he pointed out, but how do you really measure things? In other words, if your needs are met and you're not always questing after new needs and desires and things you can buy, then you're not rich, you're poor. And on the other hand, you're not poor if your needs are met, even if you don't own anything.
Right.
So in a very funny kind of a way, he was just putting all this on its head. And it was based on the picture that we have, that we've had for some time, that it was pretty darn nice the way things were. And in many things we won't ever know about, you know, consciousness and so forth, you know, lots of question marks. But and yet we still have the cartoon characters, you know, the caveman guy dragging the woman to the cave by her hair and, you know, bashing each other and grunting and so forth. I mean, it's still a kind of a silly picture that no one would want. Well, no one, unless you really know that it wasn't like that at all, you know, generally speaking. So to be the radical social theory in terms of radical stuff or liberatory departures or destinations really looks a lot different. Then modernity and mass society and progress and everything else doesn't quite measure up, especially since it's becoming catastrophic. So, you know, things look a lot different if you want to learn something from that. I mean, I think there are a lot of implications there.
You know, it seems to me that I can get a hold of some of what you're saying. These are, I mean, utopia is really not a state. It's an ideal that's based on somebody's opinion. But if you go back to the, just sort of imagine yourself there in your primitive situation, life expectancy, who knows? I suppose it all seems really idyllic. And all of the science fiction writers of note at least suggested, if not overtly stated, that decentralization will be the end of civilization. And we have the tool for that right now. I've said it many times. The internet is a great tool for uniting. It's also a terrible privacy invader. And it enables people to send little email quips back and forth rather than actually have a conversation. Now, obviously, there are many more people on this planet than were in antiquity, we think. But the experts are continuously baffled on exactly what the population levels were at given times in history. So I guess this all leads up to the question, doesn't it take a small band of people to get along? Or the smaller the band, the more liability you have as far as harmony being maintained is concerned. You think it's easier to do with a, I would think it'd be an easier job with a smaller group.
Yeah.
More difficult as your population gets bigger.
Right. If once you lose that face-to-face interaction, then you start to lose the accountability, the responsibility. I lived in a housing co-op here in Eugene for 15 years, and I'm not saying it was banned society, but it was about 50 people, and somebody was messing up. They were in the group, you know, and they had to kind of face the music. So you could take responsibility. In fact, you had to. That was the whole idea of the co-op. And I think probably for survival, in many cases, people had to do that in banned society to make it work. You know, it was not just a game. I mean, there were all kinds of conscious tactics that people were used. And we know that from surviving hunter-gatherer groups, the different ways they had to combat hierarchy, for example.
So primitive does not necessarily mean uncivilized.
Well, right. And that's, I think, a very important distinction. Primitive is a very imprecise word. In other words, if domestication is the real watershed, and I think it is, then you can have primitive societies that are already domesticated and already having things like human sacrifice or headhunting or genital mutilation or you name it, all kinds of unpleasant things, but never prior to domestication, primitive but undomesticated is what I'm talking about. Because once the domestication comes, it's amazing how that poisons the well over and over and over again, and you can hardly find any exceptions to that.
You know, John, 99%, I'm sorry to say, well, maybe I think I've managed to roll it back to about 95% of all of my contact with my fellow humans, or whatever the relationship might be, is done over a telephone.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer telephone to email. I do send email. I do receive email. I do read email. But I prefer talking to the person. And this is kind of beneficial because I can read, I think at least I can read people pretty well just by listening to them. And I'm listening to you, and you sound like a pretty mellow guy. Mm. Now, some of this stuff, just to read that, now, I don't think you wrote this little background piece that I had here. It's just based on Command's research and what little I could do. What is your life's work, and what actually led you to think the way that you do, and what are you trying to achieve with your work?
Wow. Well, thanks for asking. I mean, it's been a long, strange road, I guess. I'm 68, and I'm sort of a child of the 60s. And my biggest learning experience in terms of anarchy kind of stuff wasn't from reading anarchists or theory. It was a union experience I had. I found myself in white-collar job in San Francisco, and there was a union there. If you'll give me a couple of minutes, I will run this down. Is that okay to take a few minutes on this?
Absolutely. Just when you hear the music, you'll know we need to take a break. So take a breath when you hear the music. Otherwise, let it rip.
Okay. Well, this is Social Services in San Francisco, and I had just come to work there, and there was a fellow named Donnelly, and at 10 minutes, he was going to retire. I was just feeling my way around, and anyway, at 10 minutes to 5 on the Friday, he was going to retire in 10 minutes. He was fired so that they wouldn't have to pay his pension, and he was a sweet old guy. He was what we kind of called lifers, you know, somebody who just did the job, but they weren't going to be involved in any kind of, you know, militant stuff or anything like that. And it was so incredibly shocking. And the union, organized labor, the official union there, did nothing. Nothing we can do. And we just looked at each other and we just said, this can't be right. So we were forced to form our own union. It was kind of do-it-yourself union. And I was involved in that more and more during about 4 or 5 years when I was there. And it was a huge learning experience in terms of the bureaucracy and institutions. I mean, the unions hated us more than the bosses did. So it really was, what's going on? So, and then I went off into writing. I was really more of an organizer than an employee. And writing a lot. And so I went on to grad school, actually. I left there, and I was writing about early unions. And what I really began going off into is the Industrial Revolution, the factory system, the, you know, textile mills in England. That was the beginning of it, you know, a little more than 200 years ago. And what I began to discover, just again by chance, was that when you herd people into the factories, you can discipline them. And in England, you had all these more independent, autonomous people, like the hand loom weavers, that comes to mind as a kind of classic group. They're working at home. They're scattered around. They're not, you know, working 16 hours in a factory, and they can riot whenever they want, if they want to. And so, in other words, the domination was not complete because these people were going to raise the roof if the price of bread went up or whatever it might be. And an amazing amount of battles were happening all the time. In other words, there were people that noticed it wasn't just economics that started the factory system. It was a need to have a coercive structure in place for society. And then I began to think, I mean, that was a real eye-opener. Well, I began to wonder whether maybe all technology has some inherent choices or values. I'm not saying it's all a concentration camp, but, you know, maybe technology is not neutral. Maybe there's always something there in it that comes from society and that we never really notice because we're always told it's neutral. It's just a discrete thing. It depends on how you use it. It's not political, so forth and so on. Well, if that's not true, then, you know, then we began to have a public discussion, at least one would hope, about the nature of technology and the choices that we have. I mean, I think we've been making these choices pretty unconsciously. You just go along with it. Technology always goes forward. It never goes backward. You always have more specialization. And it just seems like a natural occurrence. But it isn't, really. I mean, it is if you just let it go.
Understood. Okay.
So anyway, that led all the way down to questioning domestication and civilization.
Well, we'll get into all of that and a lot more. This is good. We'll just roll out the carpet slowly, yes? And keep those ripples out of the middle of it. We'll continue our most singular discussion with John Zerzan, self-proclaimed anarchist. We'll see what he means by that when Coast to Coast AM continues. Well, he is a self-proclaimed American anarchist, and I was just looking at the definition of anarchy, and that's not really a very nice word, except, or definition is even worse. A state of disorder due to absence or non-recognition of authority, or absence of government and absolute freedom of the individual, regarded as a political ideal. regarded as a political ideal. So, as long as we're here, why don't we explore the possibility that maybe the only way to fix something is to just tear the whole thing down and start over. We'll continue with John Zerzan in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John Zerzan, do any of those words apply to you? I mean, it says American anarchist. Are you an anarchist, in your opinion?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's kind of a minimum definition. That's for starters, right. I would say.
Did I hear something about the Unabomber or something like that? You knew him or you liked him or something?
Well, we had a correspondence after he was arrested, and I visited him in the couple of years he was at Sacramento County Jail.
Okay, and were you able to talk to him and get in his head a little bit and find out what his motivations really were?
Very, very similar views about technology, and that was the basis of it. I didn't know him before that, and I'm not in favor of sending bombs in the mail to people.
No.
Right away, but he wanted to meet, and so I did, I had an inside view of the whole crazy trial or non-trial, and by the way, he seemed very sane to me. He didn't seem paranoid or schizophrenic. In fact, he was probably too trusting because his lawyers were, on the one hand, every day saying to him, "Ted, we will not have an insanity defense. I know that's the one thing you couldn't tolerate because it would make a mockery of his ideas." And what he did on top of it. But so it came out that that's exactly what they were doing, but they were lying to him, and he was kind of swallowing it for months and months and months. And finally all the media knew that that's what they were doing, because they'd be in court when he wasn't in court, when he was in his cell. So it became kind of a scandal. And by the way, I'm the one who told him that the lawyers are doing the insanity defense, and he didn't know that, or he didn't want to know that, or something like that.
Well, that's about the only way to be a rap like that.
Well, that's what they thought, and they were also death penalty liberals who feel it's okay to lie to your client if you can save his or her life. That's the primary ethical thing, and so in other words, the client has no rights. If the client wants to put his life on the line for whatever his ideas or actions might be, well, you'd think, doesn't he get to do that? Not according to them.
You remember that
he found out what they were doing, it was too late to, then the judge said, well, it's a little too late for that now. We've already seated a jury. You know, you can't just pull the plug. And the guy tried to hang himself that night when that all came out, and he was left with no alternative. And then they offered him a plea deal. Well, you'll get 3 life terms and 85 years or something, but you won't get the death penalty. And what choice did he have? And again, I'm not defending, sending bombs to people, but the whole thing was rather fascist kind of jurisprudence.
Well, let me ask you this. This interview is about you. It's not about him.
Okay.
But I'm just curious, because you said that you, there was a sympathy in some of the thoughts that he had and that you have. So,
indictment of technological society.
So what was he trying to do? Send a message? I mean, actually, more specifically, John, if they had not done the insanity plea, what was he going to do? Just wade into the buzzsaw and make a political statement?
Well, he didn't really want to do that either. And his lawyers were afraid that I was going to talk him into that. And I had no intention of making that sort of presumptuous bid or advice, and I wasn't interested in that.
Right. Okay.
So, he didn't get executed, and he's still alive, and he'll be in prison for the rest of his life, and, that's that.
So he almost hanged himself, and they said, go ahead and take this, and you won't get the death penalty. You'll just be in jail for the rest of your life.
Yeah, after the suicide attempt.
Ah, well.
Then they gave him the plea deal. They didn't want to have a political trial either, I don't think. I mean, if you have the whole world listening to this kind of conversation, that's probably, there are a lot of people that don't want that to happen. And it's one reason why it doesn't happen yet now.
Well, let's just extrapolate for a minute. What would happen if it did, if that political discussion did occur in a public forum? What's the worst that could happen?
It could undo everything. It could start people thinking, you know why things are getting to this crisis point? There are reasons for it, and let's check it out and see what we might do about it instead of just this ridiculous vote for Obama or Romney or something and wonder why it's getting worse by the hour. You know, that doesn't make sense. And it's occurring to more people that it doesn't make sense. I mean, none of it makes sense. I'm looking at the cover right here of the current issue of Newsweek, July 16th Newsweek. I don't know if you've seen it. Has a woman screaming in a distorted face, and it says, "I crazy." It's the cover story, the theme of the issue. Panic, depression, psychosis, how connection addiction is rewiring our brains. And, of course, it isn't just the addiction part. It's the rest of it, whether you're addicted or not. And that's just part of it.
Well, get into it. I mean, there's no, okay, we've gotten to know each other now for the better part of an hour. Uh-huh. Just let it all hang out, man. You know, I mean, I know you keep up with all this. We had Jeffrey Smith on the first hour talking about how, you know, the big company wants to make money and patent seeds, and some of them will produce more seeds and some of them won't. And they've been shown to, their products that have come from them are shown to be not good for you, they're bad for you. Mm-hmm. So what do you see as the biggest, threat right now to, first of all, do you see civilization coming to an end as inevitable, and you think we're just going to hit the great big reset button and start over? Failing that, or even including that, what do you see as the biggest threat facing civilization at the moment?
Well, I think there's two sides of that coin. The one is the eco-catastrophe, which is now unfolding. The polar caps are melting, the glaciers are melting, the ocean is turning acidic, the extinction of species is accelerating. I mean, you name it. The severe, crazy weather, it's coming right now all over the place. And, you know, when is it going to register that it's crunch time here in terms of the physical environment? I mean, it could really hardly be more striking, more stark. And yet we're still sort of pretending like, or something. I mean, it's quite insane. And that's part of it is because you can't talk about technology. Technology is always the answer, isn't it? That's the really striking thing to me. We will turn the corner. Don't worry, technology is going to solve all these problems. Except we're not supposed to notice that technology has caused all these problems in so many cases, in so many fundamental ways. It's bringing us the very thing that it's supposed to be solving or healing. Everything it says is a lie when you start looking at it. And one of the key things to go to the other side of the coin, the social realm, forget about the environment for a moment. What about social existence? What about, you know, us as humans living together? Well, it's, go down the list of what is really happening at the hands, and just to talk about the technology of part of it, and that's not all of it, but one of the key things to me is community. Community is gone. It is dead. And we're not supposed to notice that either. We're in mass society, which is now techno society. And what is it like? Well, technology says we're all connected now. We're all wired together. But just the opposite is the truth. We've never been more isolated. It's getting really scary, the levels of isolation and friendlessness. You know, there's there's tons of studies, but one of the main ones, just to mention something here. This is in the American Journal of Sociology in 2006, a 20-year study of how many friends adult Americans have, and they define the friend as somebody you confide in, so we know what we're talking about roughly when you use the word term, when the term friend. Anyway, 20 years ago, that is mid-80s, 20 years from the beginning of the study, average American had three friends. 20 years later, in the mid-2000s, average American had two friends. That's 50% fewer friends. And the number of people with no friends has tripled. And 2006, 6 years ago, I'm sure it's much worse now, even in just 6 years. I met a young couple from Australia traveling in this country for a while. They were on their way back to California to go back to Australia, and they'd done a fair amount of hitchhiking. And they were telling me that the key thing that stood out and was really disturbing was how many times, in terms of the hitchhiking mainly, they would get picked up by somebody who would just start talking about how they have no friends. They're completely isolated. Will you be my friend? Can we hang out? Can we go do something together? And they just were like, what is going on? Over and over. So, I mean, we try to get by. We're still human. We're still, you know, reach out to each other as best we can. I'm not saying we don't, but it's becoming a place where, in the absence of community, now we have the shootings. And I'll tell you, John, I have a weekly radio show myself. I don't get to have 3 hours, but the thing I come back to a lot, and some people say all too much, is the rampage shootings, school shootings, you know, the various kinds of people just snapping, killing a bunch of people. We're having more and more of that. And especially in the last couple of years, it's family shootings. Parent slaughters the whole family and then blows his brains out. Happens every day now. We're not supposed to notice that. Nobody says a thing about it. Isn't that something?
Interesting, I mean, yes.
It implicates everything. You think Obama's going to talk about that? Say, my fellow Americans, let's talk about this horrific fact staring us right in the face. What does that tell us about society? You know, forget about the fact that we have a disaster all over the world in terms of the environment, the physical environment. Well, what about the psychic environment? You know, it's shredding. And that's only the most extreme part of the pathology. But it just freaks me out. We've got grandkids right here in Eugene, a five-minute bike ride away. And I'm just wondering, what kind of world are they getting? What kind of world will it be 5 years down the road? You tell me what the healthy trends are.
I don't see one.
The avoidance there is. It's just sick how we're avoiding everything. We're talking about nonsense. I mean, in terms of politics, in terms of the, you know, quote, mainstream respectable politics.
Yeah, it's pretty, let me ask you something. Are you familiar with Patrick McGoohan's series he did back in the late 60s called The Prisoner?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Amazing series.
Okay, well, you pretty much answered my question. It was a village for retired spies, but everybody had a number and everything was good morning, good morning. It's another beautiful day. The flavor of the day is strawberry, and it was all about mind control. Mm-hmm. So who do you see behind the curtain? I mean, is this something that we're just compelled to do like lemmings? They run to the ocean en masse and en masse, and then here we go. I mean, it seems to me we have more technology than we actually use now. My computers will do much more than I am capable of doing with them. So it's like, you know, we're behind the technology airplane by about two moves. And it's getting faster, and it seems to me like the ground is getting closer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well put.
Well, what about, I mean, really, I don't know where the heck to take this, John, because, I mean, I am so much in agreement with you, but it's like you either deal with what you have and try and have some justice for people. Some people get justice and some don't. I mean, some people live to be 100 and some don't. So it just seems like, look, an old hippie like you, and I'm right behind you. You got a few years on me, but, you know, sure. I still remember the 60s. I was really too young to enjoy the 60s and fully absorb it until later. But I find that the arguments that I now understand are the same today as they were then. And there's even more of a police state to keep them subdued. Now, am I going off the radical cliff here, or am I close?
Well, it sounds right to me. Well, I remember, I don't remember this, actually. I was quite unaware of this. Only later did I. Some people were aware of the technology aspect or the technology question. In fact, you might have seen this somewhere. Stuart Brand, you know, the Whole Earth Catalog guy?
Yeah.
Said, and I don't know exactly when this was. It must have been in the 70s. I saw this on film, actually. He was repeating it, and he said, Some of us saw the question as this: technology, yes or no? And they answered yes. I mean, I wasn't aware of the question at the time, so I mean, I wasn't even playing. But that was the wrong answer. Now we just are rushing along. And by the way, Stuart Brand is now all in favor of nukes and all this crazy stuff, and that's the logic of that, I guess. You can, I'm not saying it necessarily sweeps you away to every extreme position if you think that's extreme, but we should have been thinking about that. And in terms of the 60s, some of us later were sitting around thinking, why did that end? What weren't we thinking about? What was the flaw, or something like that? Like, it's all over, and then wow, and it's over. You know, and some people couldn't even take the fact that it was over. You know, they couldn't deal with that. But that's the thing. I mean, that's such a huge part of it. We're so immersed in the whole techno thing in so many ways, and as you say, we all have to cope with it. You know, we don't have a choice. I remember there were a few of us that were making some posters about this in the early 80s. That was when the PC explosion happened. I remember some of those, like the IBM ads with the Charlie Chaplin figure. That was brand new. It's just exploding. Everybody was going to get a PC, and, you know, and everybody did. And anyway, we made some posters kind of questioning that, like the dark side of that. And one main response we get was, well, you don't want a PC? Don't buy one. What are you whining about? What are you heckling us about? And, okay, but how soon was it that there ain't no choice at all? You can't go to school, even little kids. It's all computerized. It's all wired. When I started doing speaking tours, I was naive enough to, I was talking to somebody about writing to people to see if I could get a gig. You know, you want somebody to come and talk, I'll be there, you know. And this person said, write to them, knowing I meant actually write a letter, you know, like you speaking on the phone, kind of old-fashioned. And he said, you can write a letter, but you won't get an answer. You've got to email. And I didn't want to have an email account. I didn't want to do that. But you got no choice. I could sit here with my quill pen writing a letter, and, you know, people don't have time for that. They're not going to sit down and write you a letter. I mean, what age are you in? And then I realized, yeah, I've got to do that too. There's a lot of things we got to do, and it's no free choice at all. And unless we start deconstructing this, putting it on the table and taking it apart and saying, is this really where we want to go? But you can't get anywhere unless we can talk about it. And if it's neutral, there's nothing to talk about. But it's not neutral. I mean, to me, that's just the whole fallacy of it. It's just like the whole thing that we're all connected now. We're not. I mean, all these things, you can go down the list of the claims that it makes, and none of them are true. To my mind, none of the basic ones make sense at all. But, you know, we're hit on all sides. On all sides, and, you know, we're comforted by the fact that now everything is green and sustainable. In fact, if you use green and sustainability a couple of times in every sentence, that proves it.
Although, oh, absolutely.
You know, there's nothing sustainable about this system. Let's face it. It's not. It's a cancer. It's, you know, that's really not the case. So we better face it and start from there.
Gotcha. All right, we're going to take our top of the hour break. Got a little email here. Okay. I should put a little spin on it. Isn't technology, John, just the latest set of manacles that the Rothschilds has convinced us to put on as a mere fashion? We are trained to die in their war, get sick under medical care, and how to spend our time clouded with these techno gimmicks. They have run and profited from our sorrows, ignorance, and misery since 700 AD. We live, cry, and die on their command, and we just seem to take it. You know why that is? Because we can. This is Coast to Coast AM.